McGraw-Hill Ascent Audio presents The Essentials of Risk Management, 3rd Edition, by Michelle Cruy, Dan Galai, and Robert Mark. Narrated by Michael Butler Murray. Publisher's Note: This audiobook has bonus material. Please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. All figures, tables, and boxes referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Forward. I think that the concept of the Cruy, Galai, and Mark book, The Essentials of Risk Management, is brilliant. In my career as an academic and in investment management, I found that there is too large a separation between the technocrats who build risk management models and systems and those who should be using them. In addition, the model builders seem to me to be too far from economics, understanding what risk management can and cannot do, and how to structure the risk management problem. Cruy, Galai, and Mark bridge that gap. They bring the academic research together with applications and implementation. If risk management model builders come to appreciate the economics underlying the models, they would be better prepared to build risk management tools that have real value for banks and other entities. And as the authors bring up time and again, board members of corporations must also become as familiar with the models and their underlying economics to ask the correct follow-up questions. First, risk management is often described as being an independent activity of the firm, different from generating returns. Second, most macro and micro models in economics start from a framework of certainty and add an error term, a risk term to represent uncertainty. When describing predicted actions that arise from these models, the error or uncertainty term disappears, because the modelers assume that it's best to take expectations as their best guess as to future outcomes. In both cases, however, this is incorrect. Risk management is part of an optimization program, the trade-offs between risk and return. As described in the book, the three tools of risk management are A. Reserves, B. Diversification, and C. Insurance. With greater reserves against adverse outcomes, the risk of the firm or the bank is reduced. However, greater reserves imply lower returns, and the dynamics of the reserve need to be known. For example, if a bank needs capital or liquidity reserves to shield it against shock, is the reserve static or can it be used? And how is it to be used at time of shock? If it is a reserve that must always be at a static level, it is not a reserve at all. These are important optimization and planning questions under uncertainty. With more diversification, the bank reduces idiosyncratic risks and retains systematic risks, which it might also transfer to the market. Diversification has benefits. But if a bank earns profits because its clients want particular services, such as mortgages, it might want to concentrate and make money by taking on additional idiosyncratic risk, for it is not possible to diversify away all risks and still earn abnormal profits. The bank must respond to its clients' demands and, as a result, take on idiosyncratic risks. The same is true of insurance. Unlike car insurance, wherein, say, the value of the car is knowable over the year, and the amount of the insurance is easy to ascertain, as the book describes, the bank might not know how much insurance and when it might need the insurance, nor does it know the dynamics of the insurance plan as prices change in the market. That is why risk management is integrated into an optimization system, where there always are trade-offs between risk and return. To ignore risk considerations is inappropriate. To concentrate on risk is inappropriate. The boards of banks or corporations are responsible to understand and challenge the optimization problem. Likewise, modelers must always understand the economic trade-offs. Prior to the financial crisis of 2008, many banks organized their risk management activities in line and not circle form. That is, the risk department was separate and below the production department. The risk management systems of the future must be designed such that the optimization problem is the center of focus. This involves deciding on the level of capital employed, not only for working capital, or physical investment capital, or human capital, but also the amount of risk capital in deciding on the profitability of various business lines and how they coordinate with each other. Risk management involves measurement and model building. This book provides us with a description of many of the problems in building models and in providing the inputs to the models. But once the senior management and the modelers understand the issues, they will change their focus and address the modeling and measurement issues. For example, there are three major problems in the model building / data provision or calibration of the model framework. 1. Using historical data to calibrate the model. 2. Assuming the spatial relationships will remain unchanged, such as how particular assets are grouped together into clusters, or how clusters move together. And 3. Assuming that once the model is built and calibrated, that others don't reverse engineer the model and its calibration, and game against those using the model. There are myriad examples and applications of each of these, or these in combination with each other in this book. For example, the rating agencies used historical data to calibrate the likelihood of declines in housing price, such that homeowners would default on their mortgages. Unfortunately, they used too short a time period and assumed incorrectly that the best prediction of the future would be provided from these short-period data inputs. They also assumed that homeowners default on their mortgages randomly, while ignoring the possibility that the independent clusters of possible mortgage defaults that they assumed existed would become one cluster during a crisis, such as the 2008 financial crisis. Moreover, once they provided their ratings on complicated mortgage-structured products, market participants reverse-engineered how they rated mortgage products and gamed against them by putting lower and lower quality mortgages into structures to pass just the ratings level that they wanted to attain. These three lessons are pervasive in risk management and are illustrated brilliantly in one form or the other over and over in this book. There are decisions that should be made in part proactively and decisions that should be made in part reactively. Risk management includes an understanding of how to plan to respond to changes in the opportunity set and to changes in the costs of adjusting assets and to financing activities. There is a value in planning for uncertainty. Ignoring risk might supply large short-term profits, but at the expense of survivorship of the business. For not setting aside sufficient risk capital threatens survivorship of the business. And understanding includes evaluating the returns and risks of embedded and explicit options. All risk management systems require a careful combination of academic modeling and research with practical applications. Academic research highlighted in this book has made a major contribution to risk management techniques. Practice must be aware of the underlying assumptions of these models and in what situations they apply or don't apply and adjust them accordingly. Practical applications include understanding data issues and providing inputs to these risk models and in calibrating them consistent with underlying economics. The 2008 crisis highlighted once again the importance of risk management. I believe that all board members must become as conversant in risk management as in return generation. That will become a prerequisite for board participation. This book highlights the importance of these issues. Myron S. Scholes, Frank E. Buck Professor of Finance Emeritus, Stanford University, Graduate School of Business, 1997 recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Introduction to the Second Edition, Reforming Risk Management for the Post-Crisis Era. Half a dozen years and more have passed since the start of the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, and even the European sovereign debt crisis of 2010 is fading into history. In neither case can we be sure that the crises are fully resolved. And their aftershocks and ramifications continue to shape our world. However, enough time may have elapsed for us to absorb the main lessons of the crisis years, and to begin to understand the implications of the still unfolding reforms of the world's financial industries. In this second edition of The Essentials of Risk Management, we have revisited each chapter in light of what has been learned from risk management failures during the crisis years. And in this introduction, we pick out key trends in risk management since we published the first edition in 2006. However, we have also tried to prevent the book as a whole becoming too dominated by the extraordinary events of 2007 to 2009 and the immediate succeeding years. Some of the lessons learned in those years were lessons that earlier crises had already taught risk managers, and that were covered in some detail in the first edition of the book, even if some firms found it hard to put them into practice. The crisis years also spawned a series of fundamental reforms of the regulation of financial institutions. And one thing we can be sure of in risk management is that major structural changes create new business environments, which in turn transform business behavior and risk. One of the curses of risk management is that it perennially tries to micromanage the last crisis, rather than applying the first principles of risk management to forestall the next. A trap we have tried to avoid. We hope this book contributes to the attempt to strengthen the overall framework of risk management by encouraging the right mix of theoretical expertise, knowledge of recent and past events, and curiosity about what might be driving risk trends today. The financial crisis that started in the summer of 2007 was the culmination of an exceptional boom in credit growth and leverage in the financial system that had been building since the previous credit crisis in 2001 to 2002, stimulated by an accommodative monetary policy. The boom was fed by an extended period of benign economic and financial conditions, including low real interest rates and abundant liquidity, which encouraged borrowers, investors, and intermediaries to increase their exposure in terms of risk and leverage. The boom years were also marked by a wave of financial innovations related to securitization, which expanded the capacity of the financial system to generate credit assets, but outpaced its capacity to manage the associated risks. The crisis uncovered major fault lines in business practices and market dynamics. Failures of risk management and poorly aligned compensation systems in financial institutions, failures of transparency and disclosure, and many more. In the years following the crisis, many areas of weakness have begun to be addressed through regulation and from the very top of financial institutions, the board of directors and the management committee, down to business line practices, including the misalignment of incentives between the business and its shareholders, bondholders, and investors. Next, we summarize some of the major problem areas uncovered by the global financial crisis. The rest of the book addresses these issues in more detail. Governance and risk culture. There are many different components of risk management, but the essence of what went wrong in the run-up to the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis had more to do with the lack of solid corporate governance structures for risk management than with the technical deficiencies of risk measurement and stress testing. In the boom period, risk management was marginalized in many financial institutions. The focus on deal flow, business volume, earnings, and compensation schemes drove firms increasingly to treat risk management as a source of information, not as an integral part of business decision-making. Decisions were taken on risk positions without the debate that needed to happen. To some degree, this is a matter of risk culture, but it also has to do with governance structures inside organizations. The role of the board must be strengthened. Strengthening board oversight of risk does not diminish the fundamental responsibility of management for the risk management process. Instead, it should make sure that risk management receives some enhanced attention in terms of oversight, and hopefully, a longer term and wider perspective. Chapter 4 on corporate governance elaborates on the role and obligations of the board. Risk officers must be re-empowered. Some firms distinguish between a risk control function, responsible for quantitative measures, and a risk management function, which has a more strategic focus. Either way, it is no longer appropriate for risk management to be only an after-the-fact monitoring function. It needs to be included in the development of the firm's strategy and business model. Chief risk officers, CROs, should not just be risk managers, but also proactive risk strategists. With the strength of regulators and an angry public behind them, risk managers presently wield some clout. The trick will be to make sure this lasts in periods of recovery or growing corporate frustration with unexciting returns. Chapter 4 elaborates on the role of the CRO in a best practice institution. Inadequate execution of the originate-to-distribute business model. One common view is that the crisis was caused by the originate-to-distribute, OTD, model of securitization, through which lower-quality loans were transformed into highly rated securities. To some extent, this characterization is unfortunately true. The OTD model of securitization reduced incentives for the originator of the loan to monitor the creditworthiness of the borrower, because the originator had little or no skin in the game. In the securitization food chain for U.S. mortgages, intermediaries in the chain made fees while transferring credit into an investment product with such an opaque structure that even the most sophisticated investors had no real idea what they were holding. Although the pre-crisis OTD model of securitization and its lack of checks and balances was clearly an important factor, the huge losses that affected banks, especially investment banks, mainly occurred because financial institutions did not follow the business model of securitization. Rather than acting as intermediaries by transferring the risk from mortgage lenders to capital market investors, these institutions themselves took on the role of investors. Chapter 12 elaborates on this issue. Poor underwriting standards. The OTD model generated a huge demand for loans to feed the securitization machine, and this in itself contributed to a lowering of underwriting standards. But benign macroeconomic conditions and low default rates also gave rise to complacency and an erosion of sound practices in the world's financial industries. Across a range of credit segments, business volumes grew much more quickly than investment in the supporting infrastructure of controls and documentation. The demand for high-yielding assets encouraged a loosening of credit standards, and particularly in the U.S. subprime mortgage market, not just lax but fraudulent practices, proliferated from late 2004. Chapter 9 elaborates further on the issue of retail risk management. Shortcomings in firms' risk management practices. The crisis highlighted the risk of model error when making risk assessments. The risk control risk management function must become more transparent about the limitations of risk metrics and models used to make important decisions in the firm. Models are powerful tools, but necessarily involve simplifications and assumptions. They must be approached critically and with a heavy dash of expert judgment. When risk metrics, models, and ratings become ends in themselves, they become obstacles to true risk identification. This applies also to the post-crisis rash of new models and risk assessment procedures. Chapter 15 analyzes the problems associated with model risk. Stress testing and scenario analysis. Stress testing, discussed in Chapter 16, is now a formal requirement of Basel III and the Dodd-Frank Act, and has become a much more prominent part of the risk manager's toolkit. Properly applied, stress testing is a critical diagnostic and risk identification tool, but it can be counterproductive if it becomes too mechanical or consumes resources unproductively. It is important to approach stress testing as one aspect of a multifaceted risk analysis program. In particular, stress testing must be carefully designed to gauge the business strengths and weaknesses of each individual firm. It cannot follow a one-size-fits-all approach. Firms need to ensure that stress testing methodologies and policies are consistently applied throughout the firm, take into account multiple risk factors, and adequately deal with correlations between risk factors. Results must have a meaningful impact on business decisions. Concentration risk. Firms need to improve their firm-wide management of concentration risks, embracing not only large risks from individual borrowers, but also concentrations in sectors, geographic regions, economic factors, counterparties, and financial guarantors. For example, a concentrated exposure to one exotic product can give rise to major losses during a market shock if liquidity dries out and it becomes impossible to rebalance a hedging position in a timely fashion. Counterparty credit risk. The subprime crisis highlighted several shortcomings of over-the-counter, OTC, trading in credit derivatives, most notably the treatment of counterparty credit risk. The primary issue is that collateral and margin requirements are set bilaterally in OTC trading and do not take account of the risk imposed on the rest of the system. For example, as experienced following the failures of Lehman Brothers and the quasi-bankruptcies of Bear Stearns, AIG, and others. Counterparty credit risk is discussed in Chapter 13. Over-reliance on misleading ratings from rating agencies. Credit rating agencies were at the center of the 2007 to 2009 crisis, as many investors had relied on their ratings to assess the risk of mortgage bonds, asset-backed commercial paper issued by structured investment vehicles, and the monolines that insured municipal bonds and structured credit products. Money market funds are restricted to investing in AAA-rated assets, while pension funds and municipalities are restricted to investing in investment-grade assets. In the low-interest rate environment of the period before the crisis, many of these conservative investors invested in assets that were both complex and contained exposure to subprime assets, mainly because these instruments were given an investment-grade rating or higher, while promising a yield above that of traditional assets, such as corporate and treasury bonds, with an equivalent rating. Chapter 10 discusses ratings and the controversial role of the rating agencies. Poor investor due diligence. Many investors placed excessive reliance on credit ratings, neither questioning the methodologies of the credit rating agencies nor fully understanding the risk characteristics of rated products. Also, many investors erroneously took comfort from the belief that insurance companies conducted a thorough investigation into the assets they insured. Going forward, institutional investors will have to upgrade their risk infrastructure in order to be able to assess risk independently of external rating agencies. If institutions are not willing or able to do this, they should probably refrain from investing in complex structured products. For U.S. retail investors who lack the knowledge and the tools to evaluate and make decisions about financial products, the Dodd-Frank Act creates the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, BCFP, as an independent bureau within the Federal Reserve System. However, it is by no means certain that more vigilant consumer protection would have prevented the speculative frenzy in the housing market in the run-up to the financial crisis. In Chapter 3, we discuss the Dodd-Frank Act in more detail. Incentive compensation distortions. Incentive compensation should align compensation with long-term shareholder interests and risk-adjusted return on capital. Over the two decades before the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis, bankers and traders had increasingly been rewarded with bonuses tied to short-term profits, giving them an incentive to take excessive risks, leverage up their investments, and sometimes bet the entire bank on astonishingly reckless investment strategies. More on this topic in Chapter 4 and Chapter 17, where we discuss the RAROC, risk-adjusted return on capital, approach. Weaknesses in disclosure. Weaknesses in public disclosures by financial institutions, particularly concerning the type and magnitude of risks associated with on- and off-balance sheet exposures, damaged market confidence during the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis. This remains a significant challenge to the world's financial industries. The need to disclose more information is a requirement of Basel II and III, discussed in Chapter 3. Valuation problems in a mark-to-market world. Fair value mark-to-market accounting has generally proven highly valuable in promoting transparency and market discipline, and is an effective and reliable accounting method for securities and liquid markets. However, in secondary markets that may have no or severely limited liquidity, it can create serious valuation problems and can also increase the uncertainties around any valuations. Chapter 3 and the appendix to Chapter 1 elaborate further on this issue. Liquidity risk management. During the boom years, many banks and other financial institutions allowed themselves to become vulnerable to any prolonged disruption in their funding markets. However, the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis demonstrated, once and for all, how extraordinarily dysfunctional the interbank funding market can become in times of uncertainty. Liquidity risk is not a new threat. It lays behind the failure of LTCM, Long-Term Capital Management, in August 1998, discussed in Chapter 15, and a number of historical bank failures. In the post-crisis era, however, risk managers will need to be wary of overdependence on any single form of funding, including access to securities markets, in their day-to-day liquidity risk management, stress testing, and contingency planning. As we discuss in Chapter 3, Basel III has introduced a new liquidity framework to address liquidity risk. Banks will have to satisfy two liquidity ratios, that is, a liquidity coverage ratio, LCR, and a net stable funding ratio, NSFR. Chapter 8 discusses funding risk more broadly. Systemic risk. Of the many regulatory issues at stake in the post-crisis era, one is of primary importance. Systemic risk. How can we construct a system that prevents decisions made in a single institution or a small group of institutions, plunging the world's economies into deep recession? Somehow the system must be engineered to prevent one failure causing a chain reaction or domino effect on other institutions that threatens the stability of the financial markets. Systemic risk and the regulators' efforts to prevent it is a recurring theme in the chapters of this book, especially chapters 3 and 13. Pro-cyclicality. Banks are said to behave on a pro-cyclical fashion when their actions amplify the momentum of the underlying economic cycle. For example, through intensifying lending during economic booms or imposing more stringent restrictions or risk assessments on loans during a downturn. Pro-cyclicality partly explains the correlations between asset prices that we see in the financial sector. The forces that contribute to pro-cyclicality are the regulatory capital regime, risk measurement techniques such as value at risk, loan loss provisioning practices, interaction between valuation and leverage, and compensation-based incentives. Basel III includes several mechanisms for mitigating pro-cyclicality, such as counter-cyclical capital cushion, and reducing the reliance on cyclical VAR-based capital requirements, for example by expanding the role of stress testing. Pro-cyclicality is discussed in Chapter 3. Introduction to the Third Edition. Some additional topics. The third edition of The Essentials of Risk Management has been prepared during the COVID-19 pandemic, which affected the global economy in a major way. The pandemic, which broke out in early 2020, came after a relatively calm decade, with continuous economic growth, low volatility, and low inflation and interest rates. Rather than write a completely new introduction, we decided to keep the one from the second edition, which is still relevant today, and only highlight additional risk management topics, which have been added to this edition. The effect of fintech on risk management. One major development over the last decade is the emergence and spectacular growth of the fintech industry in terms of its revenue generation, its effects on the global financial markets, and its attraction of new capital. We decided to devote a full chapter, Chapter 5, on the effect of fintech on risk management. Many new startup companies were established to help banks and other financial institutions to be compliant with new regulations. Many others were established to help
Sample complete. Ready to continue?